From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. Two massive wildfires have been burning just north of Reno for more than a week. The Bug and Stallion fires have destroyed more than 130,000 acres of forest, sage, and rangeland, as well as parts of the greater Reno-Sparks area. Here's Washoe County Sheriff Darren Balaam talking about what he saw after the fires burned through neighborhoods.
Devastation. I mean, that's the easiest way. It is tragic. When these fires go through, it is non-discriminatory and it burns whatever can burn. But then it'll jump. So, you know, you'll have, again, we had two homes that we were driving around. It burned all the way around them, but for whatever reason, it didn't go through the homes. It went around them. So when you drive through, because I've driven it every day, where the fire burn the hottest, there is nothing left. It looks kind of like the moon's surface.
Joining me now to talk about the latest are KUNR reporters Lucia Starbuck and Mallory Shaw. Lucia, Mallory, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Lucia, first off, the Bug Fire, which is the bigger of the two, has burned for more than 10 days. First off, why was this fire so challenging for firefighting crews at the beginning?
The terrain is really steep and rocky, and this is also a very hot and dry desert landscape. And then those afternoon winds, when they kick up, they're extremely unpredictable, moving in any direction and just really help the fire explode in size. You get a couple percentage of containment, and then it would just explode in size again.
But the fires are appearing to be at least near full containment. Do first responders have any idea how long it's going to take to get these fires fully mopped up?
We're definitely at the tail end. There's no evacuations left so people can return home. Some firefighters are remaining on scene to put out any smoldering tree stumps or extinguish any remaining heat, but they need to go fight other fires now.
So what started these blazes?
We know for one woman allegedly admitted to starting the Fred Mountain Fire, which ultimately merged with the Bug Fire. It started north of Reno. She said she was arrested for arson and possession of a controlled substance. She has a court date on Monday. The other two, we don't know for sure. There's been some talk they were human caused, but we ultimately don't know.
One woman, Sherry Floyd, has died from injuries she suffered in the Bug Fire. What happened to her?
Her and her husband, Eddie, were trying to evacuate in California. But like I said, when those winds kicked up, it caused a very chaotic environment. They both suffered from severe burns and smoke inhalation. Eddie is still being treated. He's in critical but stable condition.
Several families lost their homes in the blaze. You've talked to some of those families. You know, what are you hearing from them?
9 homes were destroyed. I spent time with one couple in Red Rock, which is about 30 minutes north of Reno. And the woman, she let me come to her home. And there's just nothing left. It looks like a bomb went off. I mean, there's not a single wall standing, not a single trinket. She didn't even want me to get close because there were just nails covering the ground. One thing was standing, this bright blue barbecue, but the rest was ash and just kind of burnt walls, burnt stuff. She was pointing, this was her room, or her name is Michelle Lucero. This is her room, or this was her kitchen. I couldn't even tell because it was just completely destroyed. It's just, and you know, she doesn't really know what her next steps are. She's going to go stay in an Airbnb, but kind of that big question is, she did have fire insurance, which I was like, thank God, because we know that's been an issue in our region. But she has 2 years basically to decide if she's going to stay there and rebuild. But they just moved in January. She has hundreds of thousands of dollars left on her mortgage. So when I left them on Friday, they weren't sure kind of what they were gonna do.
Do we have any idea of how many homes were destroyed at this point?
9. So that's what officials have told us, and we're pretty sure they're mostly in that Red Rock area, which is kind of where we think Bug Fire and Fred Mountain Fire merged.
Mallory, you spoke with Kelsey Kuzmic. She was among those who were evacuated. At one point, there were as many as 13,000 people evacuated from the northern Reno-Sparks area. Her home was saved. Here's what she had to say.
Honestly, kind of apocalyptic, just scary, really. It was, apocalyptic. It was just, everything is charred. There's basically no ground cover whatsoever, so we're concerned about erosion. That's why we came here, because our home is at kind of the quarter way up Fred's Mountain, and so we're worried about everything coming down with no ground cover because it all burned. We were let in today, and there are some trees that are smoldering, and I know a lot of the residents are trying to get those out themselves, so we try to help with that on our own property. But
Mallory, what has the community done to help these folks who were affected, who were evacuated?
With Kelsey Kuzmic, I met her at the O'Brien Middle School community meeting that the incident management team had. And she was there because she was concerned about home erosion, as she just said. All the ground cover around her home burned, and there was an incident that happened recently in our community where mudslides kind of destroyed some homes, and she was scared of that happening to her own home. When she went to the community meeting, unfortunately, they were not really focusing on those issues. They were just focusing on people who had their homes burned, so she didn't have her questions answered. But when the fires were ongoing, she was telling me that she was surprised her neighbors were helping her out. Some context is that she moved up in Antelope Valley during some extreme political tensions during the presidential elections. And I mean, she moved up with her wife. She's experienced a lot of hate crimes. She's had the F slur thrown around at her. And she was surprised at getting text updates from her neighbors taking care of her animals that she had to leave behind as she saw the smoke coming up near her home. So I think that is a great example of community getting together, kind of strangely because of a fire. She was just very, very surprised that the community came together.
Lucia, we have about 30 seconds left. You've done a lot of reporting on fire insurance and people seeing their fire insurance being withdrawn from companies. Have you heard any concerns from folks about how they're going to rebuild?
Luckily, in this area, there wasn't that issue. We've heard in other parts of Reno and in Nevada that people have gotten their home insurance canceled or non-renewed. Luckily, this wasn't an issue in this particular area, but I have no idea what the future will look like.
Lucia Starbuck and Mallory Shaw are KUNR reporters covering the Bug and Stallion fires burning north of the Reno Sparks area. Lucia, Mallory, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
People across the political spectrum are concerned about data centers, citing concern over water supplies, electrical bills, and noise. The democratic process has prompted compromises on some plans. It's even helped kill a few of the projects. But in one case involving federal land here in Nevada, the public was sidelined. KNPR's Yvette Fernandez reports for the Mountain West News Bureau.
When Patrick Donnelly walks in the desert, he sees nature thriving.
The Mojave Desert is an incredibly biodiverse place with plants and animals that thrive here that are found nowhere else on Earth.
Donnelly is with the Center for Biological Diversity, and he opposes building a data center on the land near here, about a half hour's drive east of Las Vegas.
The El Dorado Valley here is critical habitat for the desert tortoise, our iconic threatened Mojave Desert reptile.
The company, Townsite Solar 2, plans to build a data center on 80 acres near here. What makes it different from others is that it is planned on public land. It was a decision made without input from the community.
Welcome to City Council.
The Boulder City Council Hall was packed earlier this summer. Residents and city council members expressed frustrations that the Federal Bureau of Land Management approved the townsite data center adjacent to the city. This is one resident.
We have become a battleground for small versus large, David versus Goliath. What happens in our surrounding lands will resonate throughout the country.
Others voiced concern about resources.
They should be required to provide their own power.
Where is the water supply?
Townsite Solar 2 originally said it was going to build something else, a solar and battery storage facility. That application was with the city, but the builder amended the application, saying it wanted to build a data center instead. And that was a non-starter, because city regulations don't allow for data centers. And city spokesperson Lisa LaPlante says the city would be on the hook for some services.
Although it's BLM land, if there's an emergency, it's our police and fire department that will need to respond. We are going to be supplying water and taking care of wastewater.
The city and environmental groups accused the federal government of violating NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act.
Existing law says we have to go through environmental review, public participation procedures.
But a 2025 executive order by President Trump calls for accelerating AI infrastructure and data center development. It achieves that by, quote, streamlining environmental reviews and permitting for data centers.
And so no executive order can avoid or shortcut those laws.
BLM, in its decision to allow the townsite data center, said that it considered the company's application to the city for the solar and battery storage facility similar to a data center. The city disagrees.
The one is generating power, the solar and the battery energy storage, while the other consumes power.
Developer Townsite Solar declined to be interviewed for this story. It said in a statement that it intends to, quote, be a responsible neighbor and long-term partner to the city. It also touted plans to clean and return Colorado River water to Lake Mead. The BLM did not answer our request for an interview, but instead directed us to its documentation approving the data center. For now, this desert area remains undeveloped.
Biodiversity gives us clean air to breathe, clean water to drink, and we are slowly chipping away at that by developing public lands, by driving species extinct.
Donnelly's group and the Sierra Club have joined the city in an administrative appeal against the federal government in hopes of overturning the approval of the data center being built here.
It's not just about one data center on public lands. It's about the integrity of our public lands, and it's about our own future.
Meanwhile, the federal government has its own plans for data centers. It will use land on four federal sites, like the Idaho National Laboratory, for future data center and energy development projects. In Las Vegas, Yvette Fernandez, the Mountain West News Bureau.
Lake Powell and Lake Mead, the country's largest reservoirs, have hit a new record low. As of this week, Lake Mead is about 27% full, while Lake Powell is about 23% full. Jack Schmidt is a senior research scientist at Utah State University's Center for Colorado River Studies. He says this moment is even worse than when Powell reached its previous record low in April of 2023. Back then, scientists knew a big boost from snowmelt runoff was right around the corner.
The difference now is we're breaking that record, but it's only in the middle of August, and we have no idea what the coming winter is going to be. So we're breaking the record, but we're breaking the record in the face of tremendous uncertainty.
He expects the two lakes to continue to shrink through next spring, and as Lake Powell dips closer to the minimum level needed to generate hydropower, he says there'll be plenty of hand-wringing this winter, while water managers in the seven states reliant on the river continue negotiations on how best to use what's left. However, the 30 federally recognized tribes along the river have no formal seat at those negotiations. KNPR's Jimmy Romo has this report for the Mountain West News Bureau.
The Colorado River stretches 1,450 miles across the U.S., and for just 17 miles, the river flows through the Fort Mojave Indian Tribes Reservation, which spans across three states, Arizona, California, and Nevada.
Let's go to the pumps.
That's the Fort Mojave Indian Tribe Chairman Timothy Williams on a humid triple-digit day in the valley. He's showing me around the tribe's checkerboard farmland in Arizona. That's the state in which the tribe has the most water rights. The tribe has roughly been allotted 133,000 acre-feet of water a year, enough to sustain over a quarter of a million households. Most of that goes to their alfalfa and upland cotton operation, which pays for their healthcare services, housing, a state-of-the-art elementary school, and other services. But as states, cities, and the federal government fight over the future of the river, all of that is at risk, and tribes like the Fort Mojave are often left out of the negotiations.
There is a long history of not successfully including tribes in basin governance or water management.
That was Jay Weiner, a water attorney for the Kitsan Indian Tribe, co-founder and member of the Water and Tribes Initiative leadership team.
And so there is a significant tension there and difficulty presented by not bringing tribes to the table.
Back on the Fort Mojave Reservation, Williams parks his truck on the dirt road to visit the pump that takes water from the river to large central pivot irrigators.
Look at over there, multi-million dollar homes that are right there across the river. And here's our infrastructure and trying to provide for an entire people.
The pumps are housed in a metal cage above the river. When the water goes below the rock line, it's too low to be pumped.
So depending upon the decisions that are made, wherever they are, they heavily impact us, and it only comes down to a couple of feet or we can be impacted completely.
The chairman squats down to touch the water.
You can see how close it is already. It's that close, only a couple of feet determines whether or not we're able to provide for our people. It's that close right now.
Last winter, the water levels were so low that the tribe's pump was unable to pull water for their crops for 4 months. It's the first time that's ever happened. Andrew Harder is the farm manager for the Fort Mojave Tribe.
If we keep encountering these same conditions with our current pumping stations, it's going to really, really limit what we can grow here. So that's going to be one of our biggest obstacles on the farming side, which we've never had to.
Colleen Nielsch-Garcia, who is the secretary for the Fort Mojave Indian Tribal Council, says the tribe's connection to the river is much deeper than its financial benefit.
When Creator created the people, he placed the Mojave people in this area, and our traditional name is called Ahamakav, and that's people who live along the river. And he designated us as the caretakers of the river, the Colorado River.
Garcia says Fort Mojave elders can remember how the river once was.
Over the years, you know, we've seen the changes that have come, and we've seen the river being dammed up. We've seen it getting smaller and smaller, and every year, you know, it gets smaller and it just hurts our people.
The Bureau of Reclamation recently released a proposal which includes cuts for California, Arizona, and Nevada. Further cuts are still on the table. But without tribal members at the negotiating table, Jay Weiner says the proposal was underwhelming.
What we're looking at right now is it's a band-aid. I think there had been hope that what we would have is a durable 20-year framework.
This means Timothy Williams and the Mojave people are looking at an uncertain future.
These are the things that keep us up at night. These are the things that we consider, but we are a strong and resilient people, Fort Mojave, and we will continue on. No matter what takes place, you know, no matter what decisions take place out there, we will continue on, and we will continue on as a people out there.
In other words, the Fort Mojave Indian Tribe has no intention of abandoning their fight for the river. Jimmy Romo for the Mountain West News Bureau.
Thirty years ago next month, famed West Coast rapper Tupac Shakur was murdered on the streets of Las Vegas. Since then, his legacy has only grown. And now, almost three decades later, prosecutors believe they have one of the men responsible for his death on trial. Dwayne Keefe D. Davis, who is now 63, could get life in prison if he's convicted of murder with a deadly weapon with the intent to promote, further, or assist a criminal gang. He's pleaded not guilty. Jessica Hill is covering the trial for the Associated Press. I caught up with her yesterday to learn more about the case. Here's that conversation. Jessica, thanks for chatting with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
This murder happened almost 30 years ago, come next month. Help us remember what happened that night.
Yes. So in the evening of September 7th, 1996, there was a big boxing match between Mike Tyson and Bruce Seldon. And it was actually a pretty quick match. I think Mike Tyson won pretty quickly. But that drew a big crowd to Vegas that night, and that included Dwayne Davis and some of his crew members and his nephew, and that also included Tupac Shakur. After the fight, they had gotten into an altercation, not Dwayne Davis, but Dwayne Davis's nephew had gotten into an altercation with Tupac Shakur and Suge Knight and his entourage then. And then a couple hours later, Dwayne Davis, allegedly, and other people in a white Cadillac had come across Tupac and Suge Knight's vehicle, stopped at a red light near the Las Vegas Strip. And that's when shots were fired from the white Cadillac. And what makes this case so interesting, and I'm sure we'll get to it, is the fact that Dwayne Davis's own words is what is haunting him right now and what has led to this prosecution. The district attorney, who's the chief deputy district attorney who's leading this case, has said that, you know, Davis probably would never have been prosecuted if it weren't for this book that he had written back in 2019 and published in 2019 that detailed, you know, his involvement in this shooting.
All right. Who is Dwayne Keefe D. Davis, and what was his relationship with Tupac?
So Davis was, and has said, was a former leader of the Southside Compton Crips, and he had a crew mostly in Compton. And he didn't have much connection to Tupac himself. Basically, prosecutors say that He had more of a relationship with Sean Combs, but there was basically an affiliation with these two rival gangs, the Southside Compton Crips and the Mob Peru, and he was affiliated with the Crips. And prosecutors are basically saying that in the months leading up to Tupac's death, there has been a lot of retaliation and kind of gang violence that culminated the night of September 7th, 1996, that led to Tupac's death. Prosecutors have been saying that that night at the MGM Grand, Tupac and his entourage had got into an altercation with Davis's nephew, Orlando Anderson. And then when Davis had heard about that, they wanted to get retaliation, allegedly. And so then they tried to find Tupac and Suge Knight. And then they actually just like stumbled upon them near the Las Vegas Strip that night when the shots started happening.
So the prosecution is basing their entire case off the book Davis wrote?
That and public statements that he had made leading up to the book being published, he had also talked to police in 2008 and even earlier about his involvement. However, he had never been prosecuted until he started making these public statements, is when they kind of revived this cold case.
And just to be clear, Davis is not believed to be the gunman, right?
Correct, yes. Prosecutors are not alleging that he was the one that pulled the trigger, but that he orchestrated this in order to get retaliation after his nephew was beat up. And then they also say that he like provided the gun and handed the gun into the back seat of the Cadillac where the shots were actually fired. And he's the only person that has ever been, charged in connection to this death, and mostly because the other people that were said to be in the car have since died, and so he's the only surviving person who was there that night, besides Suge Knight, who survived that shooting, but he's currently in prison in California.
Lawyers were in jury selection last week. What do we know about them thus far, and what were lawyers looking for in jury selection?
So we don't know too much. It is a jury panel of 16, and four of them will be alternates, but we won't know who those are until the deliberation starts. There's 10 women and 6 men. During the jury selection process, we heard a lot of people who had like vaguely heard about Tupac. They knew that he was a rapper and that he had died in Vegas, but many of them didn't know like much more beyond that. Some had heard about when Davis was arrested, but hadn't really been following the case too closely. It was interesting during the whole process, the attorneys weren't looking for someone that had never heard of Tupac because that was kind of an unrealistic ask. So it was just interesting to see that they, didn't really mind that someone hadn't heard of him, obviously. But if it was like a major fan, then they probably would have been interested.
This trial is expected to last about 4 weeks. We've just come out of opening arguments. What are you expecting to hear from the lawyers over the next several days?
So right now we're hearing, yesterday the prosecutors laid out their case. This book that he wrote and the public statements that he had made are all like they claim that he actually did these things. And I think that's going to be like what is crucial in this case is Davis's own attorney. His whole defense is that Davis is an unreliable narrator, that he made this book for profit and not to tell the truth. That this book was fictionalized and dramatized. And basically, that Davis can't be trusted. And yesterday, on Monday, after the trial had ended for the day, his attorney, Michael Sampt, basically said, like, yes, I'm calling my own client a liar. And so it's an interesting defense to set up, and it'll be interesting to see what the jury has to say about that at the end. But prosecutors are basically trying to show what is truth in Davis's own statements and his book, and what has been, hyperbolized, basically.
And we actually have a clip of Davis's attorney, Michael Sampt, reiterating that argument to reporters earlier this week. Let's take a listen.
Yeah, you're essentially telling the jury that your client is a liar.
Yep, I am. Yes,
you're,
that's true. I
that's the
mean,
question. How do you think it's going to go down?
I hope it goes down well. I mean, but at the end of the day, we'll see what the jury says. This is the first day of trial, so we don't have all the information yet. But I think once we develop all the information, we'll see what kind of case this state really has.
One follow-up question about the believability of Keith Edeney. He said that he was in that car, that he provided the gun, that he placed himself in that white Cadillac, and now he says that he wasn't. If you want the jury to believe your client, and yet you're saying that he's a liar, why should they believe him this time around?
Isn't that the conundrum, though? Is that what version of events are you going to choose? That's the problem with the case. There's no clear answer to the question that you're asking.
What else are you going to be keeping your eye on as this trial progresses?
I think another thing that is interesting about this case is, like you said, this has been 30 years in the making. And you're really seeing that already play out in the trial. They had a couple of witnesses on yesterday, and a lot of the witnesses, you could tell that it had been 30 years and they didn't have like the best memory. They'd say like, I don't recall certain things and I don't recall certain details. I don't remember this and I don't remember that. So it's interesting to see how long this case has really been in the making and how that could affect, you know, the evidence that is available.
This trial is receiving a lot of coverage both in Las Vegas and abroad. Is that having an impact?
It definitely is. Yeah, I think even though it's been 30 years, I think Tupac's kind of legacy has only continued to grow. He continues to have a major dedicated fan base that really cares about this and like wants to see a resolution. And his family also has, you know, wanted to see a resolution, and they've been in court as well.
Jessica Hill is a Las Vegas-based reporter for the Associated Press. Jessica, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
For more than a century, Nevada's wide open basins and towering ranges have drawn scientists, artists, and writers to the state to better understand the natural world around us. Two groups that have found particular success are fossil hunters and rock hounds. And as KUNR's Lupe Alvarez reports for the Mountain West News Bureau, the hounds help paleontologists in their efforts to discover the distant past.
On a bright morning in July, the sun beat down on Hillary Loopy's white Jeep as it rattled across a dusty playa.
Everybody knows Jurassic Park, right? Before that, we had the extinction event known as the Great Dying, when 95% of life on Earth died.
Loopy is a member of the Reno Gem and Mineral Society and calls herself a rock hound. She visits the canyons and hills southeast of Walker Lake a lot to look for fossils. On a recent trip, Loopy made an exciting discovery.
As soon as I popped over the hill, the first thing I saw was like a very clearly distal femur bone laying on the ground.
Today, this area is covered in crumbling shale and dry, spiky plants. But millions of years ago, it was a tropical sea teeming with marine life. There were ammonites, squid-like creatures whose fossilized shells are among the most common in the area. It was also home to ichthyosaurs, whose name means fish lizard. They're known for their long snouts and needle-sharp teeth. Their remains are Nevada's state fossil, and that's what Loopy thought she might have found.
They were alive at one time, and they're just here as a rock.
It's legal to pick up small amounts of plant and invertebrate fossils on federal land, but finding fossilized bones can be an icky situation because you need a permit to collect them. So, Loopy pinned the location on a map and sent photographs of her find to paleontologists.
First thing that draws your eye to one if you're out prospecting is the shape.
One of those paleontologists is Gary McGoy. He works at Idaho State University. After he heard about Loopy's discovery, he visited the site to confirm whether it was a fossil or not.
And we have our little hand lenses to look up closer. You're looking for any of that kind of spongy, porous texture that shows that it's the same thing we see in modern bone.
If all else fails, McGoy says, there's one other way to confirm if something is a fossil.
The classic paleontologist licking bone to see if it sticks to your tongue.
Unfortunately for Loopy, appearances can be deceiving. The faux femur proved not to be a fossil at all.
But the way that we were able to determine that it's not is it was missing the bone texture.
While this bone-like rock proved to be, well, just a rock, it's not uncommon for hobbyists like Loopy to stumble upon unique finds. In fact, she's found ichthyosaur fossils before. That's why academics like McGoy take these reports seriously. And he's hopeful that groups like the Reno Gem and Mineral Society will get more people involved.
Keep being excited about paleontology, keep supporting these programs throughout the state, and Nevada's a really great place full of these amazing fossils.
Loopy's disappointed she didn't come across an ichthyosaur fossil this time, but she says no matter what you're looking for, rock hounding is a good way to find some peace and quiet, and maybe even take a little piece of natural history home with you.
It's like an Easter egg hunt.
And there could always be new fossils just beyond the next hill, waiting to be discovered.
KUNR's Emma Charles also contributed to that report. Southern Nevada has many places to view art, and some of it just happens to be located in fairly peculiar places. Nowadays, a drive into the desert, sometimes far into the desert, will take you to art installations that have become world famous. In particular, local art has found its way beyond the local galleries, in some instances, in high-traffic tourist areas. And while there's plenty of Las Vegas-based arts in the Arts District, one unlikely space is giving several Las Vegas-based artists a free, high-visibility spot to show their work. KNPR's Mike Pravat spoke to Scott Dickensheets, editor-at-large of KNPR's Desert Companion magazine, about all the interesting settings one finds art in Southern Nevada. But first, he chatted with attorney Isaiah Jerez about his art billboard project. And as a note, the Rena Denon Abbey Art Museum and MGM Resorts are financial supporters of Nevada Public Radio. Now, here's that conversation.
Isaiah, thanks for making the time to speak with us today.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here with you, Mike.
So how did you get the idea of putting local art on a billboard?
Yeah, so my marketing director approached me and said, hey, we've got to get a billboard up. And I let him know I don't want to be on the billboard. If we're going to do a billboard, we got to do something different. We got to be something that turns the attention to the community. And so I let him know we've got to do something looking at some type of community organization, some type of charitable organization that we can display and give the space to them and maybe give them a little shout out to us. My marketing director is very tied into the arts community, and he came to me with the idea of what if we have a rotating art billboard?
It almost sounds like it's potentially a critique of the proliferation of attorneys on billboards. It sounds like it's not necessarily that.
Yeah. When I first started doing personal injury, we put up a billboard of myself, and it was fun, right? I had friends in the community that would joke around saying, oh, yeah, I saw you over there by the freeway. Mm-hmm. You know, the billboards are an important space for attorneys, of course, because we're the brand of the firm. The thing about my firm is we really try to give back to our community. We focus on serving the community. And so I wanted the billboard to not be about me, but about what we do. And that's how my marketing director came up with this idea of, hey, there's this space downtown where we can recapture that for artists and give that back to artists.
Did your marketing director know that this worked somewhere else, or is this something he dreamed up?
I got this idea from a friend of mine who's in Ohio, and he's known as a hometown lawyer out there. And he blankets little towns that he's in Ohio with billboards. And out there, billboards are like $500, right? Really cheap for what it costs for each month. And so there was like a local celebrity out there that had this crazy mullet, and he put him up on there, kind of giving him a space. And my friend, the hometown lawyer, has been kind of rotating that space out, giving that space back to charitable organizations. So for me, the cost is a little bit different. It's not a $500 billboard. We are providing this space to the community because I think that's the best way that I can tell people about what I do.
And I got to ask, you know, you're talking about the cost of a billboard. When you go to a billboard company and say, hey, I want to buy an ad, but I'm going to do something a little different. This is for the community. Do they give you a lower rate as a result?
I don't think we're getting a lower rate. I think we're still getting pay what's required. But I understand that, right? That's a space that they have that they need to be able to provide to others. And, you know, a big cost that we are incurring is we're changing out this artwork every month.
So it sounds like you've had a pretty good response.
Yeah, no, it's been wonderful. We've had a lot of great support from the artists in the community because they see the vision that we have, right? This is not necessarily about us. This is about getting visual ownership back from downtown for those artists.
Once you came up with this idea, you buy the billboard space. How do you execute the idea from there?
Yes, it is a lot of work. And our marketing director has been working with Paco at Psionic Artworks, and he's been very integral in curating the artwork. And so we've received some inquiries directly from artists. And coming up this next month, we're going to do a call for art.
We're in our sixth month of the Art Billboard, so you are compiling works that have already been shown at an exhibit called Art Over Maine. This is going to be at Mad Gallery. It opens on Friday with a reception in the evening. So what can attendees of the event or whenever they go to the exhibit expect? Is it literally just 8 or 10 billboard works that they happen to fit inside of this gallery?
Yes. No. So some of the art isn't able to fit in the gallery, right? Other, you know, it could be too large or some of the art has been sold and is no longer in possession of the owners. But we are featuring 15 of those artists and their artwork will be there.
So it sounds like even if someone's work that has already been on the billboard has sold, you'll have other works that they've done to say, here's an artist we featured and here's some other things they've done.
Yes, yeah, exactly. It's another space for them to come in and to show their artwork.
Do you see a life for this promotion beyond the 10-month mark? Do you think there's an additional future for this promotion?
When we first entered into this project, we wanted to be committed for a year. We didn't want it to be something that just went for a couple months, but really something that the artist could rely on. And so we've decided to go ahead and move forward and doing it in 2027.
Ooh.
And providing more opportunities for artists.
And that's Isaiah Jerez of the Jerez Law Firm. He is also the originator of the Art Billboard, which highlights two local artists every month on a billboard in the Arts District. And the exhibit for it, which is called Art Over Maine, starts this Friday, August 21st at Mad Gallery, which is also in the Arts District. Isaiah, thanks so much for coming here.
Yeah, appreciate it, Mike.
And joining us now is Scott Dickensheets, editor-at-large for KNPR's Desert Companion. He's also a longtime arts writer in Southern Nevada. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
In your experience, what is usually behind efforts to have art placed in areas where one might not expect to see it?
For a lot of people who'd be placing the art, it's about serving the audience. You know, like a lot of art tends to cluster around centers of capital and places that can afford to place art around their properties or whatever. So by putting things in unusual offbeat places, you open it up to people who wouldn't otherwise go to those business and industry. So it expands the audience, and it helps the art in many cases to be seen in something other than kind of a pristine white-walled gallery or a perfectly calibrated display area. It helps recontextualize it, gives it a fresh meaning, and it exposes it to more people.
Do these works and their sort of unexpected appearances add something to the city beyond just, hey, you know, a cultural surprise? I'm thinking that some of these works sort of add to a city that has a more surreal air to it.
Yeah, and I think it sort of adds to that in an artistic and interesting way. Because a lot of the surreality of Las Vegas doesn't depend on art in any real way, other than whatever cultural manifestations you'd accrue to, like lighting and spectacle and sort of thing like that. But by putting art in these offbeat places, there is the surprise factor. But then it also suggests that Las Vegas is a community where things happen not only at the high-end level, but interesting things happen at the human level where most of us actually live and circulate.
So let's get into some specific works for a bit here. I want to address some of the far-flung pieces of art. I'm thinking right now of the large-scale land art pieces City and Double Negative by Michael Heiser. Those are both in remote areas of East Southern Nevada. And the mostly outdoor Goldwell Museum, and that's just west of Beatty. Those take at least an hour and a half to drive, at the very least, to get to. I wonder how much you gauge the experience of seeing those works by the effort that it takes to each of those remote desert settings.
Well, that's an interesting question, Mike. And one would hope that, you know, the art could stand apart from the effort made to reach it. But we're human beings, and that's not really always possible. But there are three very different works. And so I think there are probably three very different types of responses. Like when you get out to Beatty and you see the Goldwell Open Air Art Museum, they're whimsical. And some of them are very thoughtful, but also, you know, sort of fun. The effort it took to get there, you finds release in this sort of expression of joy at finding these trippy pieces out in the middle of nowhere in a ghost town, essentially. The two Heiser pieces, Double Negative and City, are a bit different because their intent is different. I mean, I've been to City. It is a long, difficult process to get to. Entrance is really well restricted. It's like six people at a time, twice a day. But it's a much more sort of immersive, deeply felt experience. And so the effort taken to get there actually becomes part of the experience, because the experience itself is so vast that it sort of subsumes the 3-hour travel time there and the 3 hours back. It all seems sort of a piece with the giant immersive, you know, sort of experience of City.
Now, if folks want to see large-scale art sculptures in the desert, they don't have to necessarily drive 3 hours over to Alamo. They only have to drive about 25 minutes south to the Jean Dry Lake, where there famously is Seven Magic Mountains. And that's, of course, the multicolored stack of rocks by Ugo Rondinone. It was installed in 2016, and its stay off of I-15 has been extended far beyond that initial two-year agreement. Scott, you know, there was initially a thought that it might move up north, but can you imagine this piece anywhere else? I feel like its position just right outside of the original Mojave Desert visual disruptor, Las Vegas, is just too perfect for that location, for that artwork to change. What's your feelings about that?
Well, I agree 100%. Even though the artist has created similar stacks for other places, somehow this feels like perfectly situated. It does a lot of really interesting things, if you ask me, which is, for one thing, it's the super bright original object that's not trying to sell you anything, which makes it an anomaly in Las Vegas from the get-go. But also, if you look around the site where it is, there's a massive freeway, there are railroad tracks, there's a quarry nearby and a shooting range. So that area of the desert has been hard used by humans. And these seven joyful, you know, buoyant stacks of brightly colored rocks are the only thing out there that redeems our presence. You know, it's the only thing that out there that says, hey, humans aren't just destructive beings. And I like that about it. In fact, every New Year's morning, I go out there and just spend some time out there contemplating that.
What a nice little yearly reset. I like that. Las Vegas artists Justin Favela and Ramiro Gomez took inspiration from Seven Magic Mountains. They colored and stacked several tires for a temporary public art display in an empty lot in East Las Vegas. That work was called Seven Magic Tires. It was initially part of an exhibit at the Barrick Museum. So this art went from a conventional art space, and then it went over to an unconventional one. Do you think that it's otherwise pretty difficult for art to make that kind of transition as effectively as that piece did?
Well, there's not a lot of art that transitions that easily from a gallery space to, you know, an exposed outdoor, you know, sort of suburban or urban setting. So, yeah, it's not a natural transition for most art. But most art, I mean, a lot of art can make it, I think. That one just happened to be a really, really good and funny and lively example of it. But I think it's not impossible for that transition to take place for other works.
Now, Scott, we have talked a lot on this program about the Rita, Dean, and Abby Art Museum, which is in an underdeveloped suburban area near Lone Mountain, I think is maybe the easiest way to describe that. It's technically part of the home where Abby lived. But now it's an art facility, and it's open to the public, and you can just drive right up to the front door. No parking garages, no meters, no downtown or university traffic to contend with. Do you think its location says anything generally about the accessibility of art?
I think it says that second-handedly. I mean, I think primarily it was built there because that's the land that the private foundation that built it owned. So, but I think that is a message that it does send. That this is like happening at the community level. And yet it's a museum quality museum. I mean, it's not some slapdash building they put up, and it's really well done. And Rita Abbey herself was, as they say, contained multitudes. She was so many different kinds of artists over her career. The collection itself is so varied that it feels less like a, you know, like a vanity project and more like a legitimate, real museum experience.
And Scott, I'm sure you have a favorite or two that we haven't mentioned, you know, something that's installed in a place where one might not go for art. What do you got?
The artist Maya Lin, artist and architect, who most people know as the creator of the Vietnam War Memorial, created this piece for the lobby of ARIA. It hangs over the check-in desk. And it is a topographical rendering in silver of the Colorado River. And it's very delicate. In fact, if you're so absorbed in checking in, you might not even really clock it. But it's delicate and it's beautiful. But it also, by rendering it in silver, it speaks to the, you know, to the value of water and the river in this context. And so, you know, you're there in this highly capitalized environment with this, you know, very conceptual representation of nature confronting you. And it's just a really, to me, a powerful experience just to observe that.
Scott, I'm wondering, you know, based on your travels elsewhere in this country, you know, to cities that might either be bigger than Las Vegas or maybe are known for having a bigger art complement, I'm wondering if you think that we are unique with some of our most well-known art showing up in some of the most non-obvious places. You know, are we just an atypical city dealing with the atypical dynamic? Or do we sort of just accept that other cities have art in places that we might not necessarily put them in, and it's just normal for those cities?
I think it's a little of each. But what makes us a little unique is just the nature of our main industry, you know, hospitality, and it's focused on a lot of things that are not, nobody would consider artistic, you know?
Yeah.
It's, people don't come here for the art, but then they come here and they find plenty of it if they just open their eyes. Whether you're in the, if you're here at a convention at the Rio, for instance, there's a lot of really cool art hanging in the hallways in that convention area by local Las Vegas artists whom we know. And that's just like one of many examples. And so to find art represented in places where the real job is fleecing the tourists, I think that sort of sets it apart in a certain way.
And that's Scott Dickensheets. He is the editor-at-large for Desert Companion, where he has written about many of these uniquely placed works of art. Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Mike.